Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I had a very peculiar experience yesterday. So with your indulgence, I'll relate it. I was walking down the street in Oakland in the Temescal neighborhood, which is very interesting. And I passed this bookshop I go into called Free Books, Libros or something like that. And they're not free, but they're inexpensive and excellent. And right out in front of the store, there was a dude lying on the ground, a homeless guy. And he was, you know, doing that kind of rallying, well, you're going to have it again, kind of half understood speech thing. And as I passed, it was noticeably violent. He was like, well, am I going to cut his legs? I'm going to cut him, you know, I'm going to cut this guy. And then I turned around and looked, and he was actually holding a knife. So he was kind of like spinning a knife on the pavement. And there was a woman behind me, and she passed. And as soon as she passed, he changed the gender to her. So he was clearly responding to his immediate field, and he had this knife. And I had a couple of double takes to make sure nothing was happening or whatever. And it was the knife was really weird because it was sort of flashing in the sunlight. So it wasn't just an object. It was also this kind of radiant slice of my experience. And then I noticed that there were these two guys in front of me who were kind of pointing at me and looking at me, and it turned out that they were looking at me, looking at him. And then we had this really weird conversation. Like, one of them may have been homeless, hard to tell. The other guy seemed, you know, he could have been a shopkeeper or whatever. And he immediately started talking, not at all like, oh, God, is that guy going to do something? Or like, oh, it's too bad, he's crazy or whatever. But he started talking about him almost like he didn't quite envy him, but he was saying, look how far he's gone. You know, I wonder sometimes if you actually go that far, whether you can come back, you know. And it was this idea of kind of letting go all of the attempt to control your life and be the one in control and be the subject. And he was like, yeah, you know, I think I'm in control, but I'm not in control. And, you know, I was on my way to therapy. It was very peculiar. It was like one of those little moments in life where like, words and images and events just kind of stitched together, and you're kind of more like in a novel. You're in a fiction. And I thought about that event today in going over our guest J.F. Martel's book, his new book, Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice, A Treatise, Critique, and Call to Action, an extremely fresh and satisfying manifesto, which I'll talk a little bit more in a second. But one of the things he talks about in there is the idea of the rift, and that part of what makes art powerful, delightful, necessary, and terrifying is that it contains within it a kind of crack, a kind of glimpse or glimmer, or and sometimes a very strange mixture of kind of wonder and terror that indicates to us that we're outside of our normal realm of everything leading to something else. It's all kind of instrumental. We're doing this in order to do that. Like the guy I was talking to said, like, I think I'm in control. Am I really in control? And then suddenly things erupt out of an artwork, out of a dream, in the surface of the everyday, and there's a glimmer and a glimpse of some different order, something that's chaotic but also full of meaning. That's something that seems bizarre but also more real than the reality that we normally experience. And so it really struck me how both close and often distant these kinds of experiences can be as we sort of surf through our postmodern lives. And it reminded me, even at the time, of another experience that is something else that JF talks about in the book, which is when you see mistakes in art. And he's talking about the difference between a classic in the good sense and a masterwork, where in a masterwork, the artist is totally in control of their material. Everything is perfect. Everything is excellent. Everything is the best it can be. But there's often a kind of airlessness about it, a little bit cold, a little bit not really sure how you're going to interact with it, what you're supposed to do with it. Are you just supposed to be impressed? What do you do? And then he compares that to the classic, which is a sort of endlessly bounteous work where no matter how many times you read it and and go back to it, and there's more to say, there's more to recognize, there's more to resonate with. But a lot of these works actually have a lot of flaws in them. They're awkward parts, there's mistakes, there's what in film you call continuity errors. And I had seen one just the night, a couple nights before I rewatched The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, an excellent John Huston film with Humphrey Bogart playing a particularly disturbing character. And there's one scene where there's just the camera's panning and you can see that they kind of blew it, and they left there's a shack right next to the area where they're shooting, which is supposed to be the middle of nowhere. And, you know, it's just there for a second. And it's strange how those kind of, rather than throwing you out of those of the kind of trance of the film, the narrative trance, depending on the film, in a great film like this film, it actually kind of somehow folds it back in a weird way, as if you're like even closer to the experience of the character or the artistry of Bogart's performance in this work of popular cinema that nonetheless crosses over into a certain kind of aesthetic beauty. So with our quest for the rift, we'll proceed to the conversation. But before bringing on JF's, we'll introduce, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Have you experienced any rifts lately?
I feel like that happens on a daily basis. But yeah, it's true. I feel very much in agreement with you with how that kind of terrifying purpose of art can kind of, you know, reveal those rifts, those little knife slits in reality. And I think, like you said, it's the realization that things are not what you think they are. Like, people think they're, you know, if they just do this, everything will be cool. But then they see something where they're like, oh, that's not anything like I would think I could be or that should be. And then they have this kind of like existential dilemma. I think art is really good for progenerating existential dilemmas that cause our brains to think we don't know everything there is to know.
Exactly. And it's precisely that encounter with kind of the excess and the unknown that JF is getting to in Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice. So with no further ado, JF, welcome to Expanding Mind. We got you. Oh, hello. There we go.
Hello.
Hey there. Sorry.
Hey.
There's usually a little gremlins at the beginning of the call.
So, yeah.
thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind. Congratulations. Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice, I think, is just about hitting right now. And, you know, it's sort of rare to encounter a manifesto these days. It's kind of an old school form. And, you know, reading your book, it was really very revealing for me, not just in terms of the arguments you were making, but, you know, in some ways, you're really cutting against a kind of the sort of cynicism of our world today, where everything is sort of used for some purpose and all artists are just sort of hired guns of various forces in capitalism. And if you start talking some of the terms that you use in your book, where you're talking about a return to beauty, a return to the kind of expressivity of art, detaching it from particular political goals or instrumental roles in society, you know, a lot of that initially, it's I realize how much I've been kind of programmed by contemporary thought. We're this is reactionary. This is the old pre-critical way of talking about art. But actually, you make it, all of these things are reframed and brought into the now. It's an extremely fresh response. Very, it stirs us up, stirred me up. It made me realize how much I had kind of gone along with a certain kind of cynicism about what the, you know, sort of true range of art could be. And so it's, you know, it's really quite interesting work, and it's very, very well written and very smart without being jargony or feeling like I'm stuck in a art critical class or something like that. So overall, very, very, very good. Very good job there, sir.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Well, I realize that It's a work of kind of hopeless romanticism, perhaps, but it's meant to inspire, I guess, in the end.
Well, that's sort of one place to start. I mean, I think your story that you recently published about why you wrote the book is a good place to start as well. But it really does go to if we're really serious, if we look the way that I thought about it, if I look inside myself and I am actually still really upholding some of these, let's call them romantic ideas, that the work of art can be transformative, that there is another order of reality, that it allows you to glimpse, even if that reality doesn't necessarily exist in the way that tables and chairs do, that there is something great in great works of art, that this doesn't have to do with just my cultural programming or the way that my neurology works, that there's an order of presences and encounters. If I'm really serious about that, how do we justify it these days? How do we talk about it in a way that isn't just reactionary or that isn't just like, oh, you know, you find that, you know, all the critics today, they don't understand. Like, you really go in there and look at why people say the things they do now and yet try to carve out a space for something else. But in your case, this really came out of your own experience as an artist working in industry, dealing with incredibly creative people, and also dealing with the kind of, let's call them sellouts or kind of deadlocks that arise as you try to make a living in our economically stressed age. So maybe you tell that story as a way to talk about how you came to write this book.
All right. Well, I was working in Montreal at the time, and I was it was for this huge multimedia. Well, now they're a pretty huge multimedia company. They do shows all over the world. I don't want to name it because I still have friends there and stuff. And I have nothing against the company or the people there who are incredibly creative, smart people. But we were working on this one contract that involved developing developing folklore for a gated community in the South. That's basically in the U.S. So basically we were taking the names off the geological survey map of the area where this community was built, which was in the middle of nowhere, and we were making up characters and a history and a sense of belonging for the people who would live there. And this spectacle, this kind of mythos, I guess, would have been projected on the square, the kind of town square of this little community. And it was in working on that project that I realized that the aesthetic... I realize how prevalent art is today, how aesthetic images surround us. We're kind of drowning in them. And at the same time, how this use of them seems to go against what I experience when I read a great novel or watch a great film. There seems to be a categorically different intention behind it, and therefore a different result. So I'm kind of like putting that project that I worked on in the same category as I would like a Coca-Cola commercial or that sort of thing. The use of aesthetics to deliver ideas or to influence taste, as opposed to the use of aesthetics to kind of free up the mind and have you realize how strange life is, you know, and how you can't reduce anything. Yeah.
Yeah, we can dig in there a little bit. I think one of the points is that you talk about Wilde, you introduce a lot of people who have an angle on this notion, is that there is something, purposelessness is an important part of art, and it's significant. You really underscore that, purposelessness. There's not really an instrumental purpose. That doesn't mean it doesn't do things. That doesn't mean you don't want it to do things, but there sense in which everything today is kind of roped in to an instrumentality, whether people are how they represent themselves in social media, the purposes they put their private lives to. Everything is becoming part of this kind of spreading logic of instrumentality, where everything you're doing for a reason to produce an effect that you're kind of in control of, or at least you're intending to set in motion. And that instrumentality has a really corrosive effect, particularly with art, where you sort of want it to be more. And in some sense, you're even still getting the simulacrum of that more. You know, you're getting some sense that like, oh, this is meaningful. It's multiple dimensions. But what you're actually getting is kind of a trick ride or what you call artifice. I mean, isn't that part of what you're trying to define in the difference between art and artifice?
Yeah, that's at the most kind of basic level. There's a distinction there that I make between art and artifice. It's a bit of a vulgar distinction, but it's useful, I think, and it's essential that we make it. But from there, it gets a lot more subtle from there. But I took the theory, the art and artifice thing comes from James Joyce's theory of art that he gives in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where his character, Stephen Dedalus, starts describing his personal aesthetic theory to his friends. And he talks about how art, there's proper art and there's improper art. And what's the difference? Well, he says improper art tries to get you to feel a predetermined emotion and has a kind of physiological goal to kind of hit the reptilian brain, let's say, like to really ignite a very specific desire. And it presents to you an object which you are then manipulated into either being attracted to or being repelled by. That's improper art. Proper art presents to you an object which exists in this weird zone between repulsion and attraction, where you have your own singularity, your own individuality is as determining of your reaction to it as the thing, as the presentation of the thing is itself. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
I mean, one of the phrases you use is that art is involved in our own capacity to be affected. And that seems to me a really key aspect of it as well, is that the more that the thing is like an advertisement, so the advertisement, like my wife doesn't really like watching films very much, and one of the reasons is that she often feels really manipulated, and mm-hmm. she's almost this kind of naive subject where she can watch a McDonald's commercial and start to kind of tear up because she's just really affected by those kind of manipulative moves that we then, as more sophisticated watchers, learn to look at ironically, like, oh, they're just trying to manipulate us or whatever. But we're so used to that mode that we give up cultivating that part of ourselves that is capable of being drawn into something terrifying, something larger, something exquisitely beautiful. We give up our capacity to be affected because we become ironical and cynical. Everything is trying to manipulate us. And at the same time, all we can do is sort of let ourselves be manipulated. And that's really different than the capacity to be affected, which in some sense does reflect our individuals, our singularity, our capacity to be affected, which is different. You know, different people, different cultures, there are different degrees of this. And so you're not just talking about art as some object, something that an artist makes and da-da-da. You're also talking about a whole sensibility that even goes beyond art, which is part about increasing and cultivating that capacity we have to be affected.
I think the capacity to be affected is our great loss. We've lost it, and it's probably our greatest loss since the wars and the disaster that was the first half of the 20th century. I think, and J.G. Ballard talked about this. He described it as a death of affect, and Deleuze, who's probably my favorite philosopher, the one I keep going back to anyways, he talked towards the end of his career, kept talking about how we need to believe in this world. We've ceased to believe in this world. And I don't think that any change is possible until we develop some kind of modality that allows us to re-engage with something bigger than us, something that is larger, more expansive, that is unknowable, maybe impossible to articulate. And that whole aspect of reality that in the book I refer to as the real, with I believe I use a capital R, I can't remember now, but with the real, that whole aspect of reality is kind of exactly what our culture tries to blind us to and to close us, to hem us off from, you know. So to be affected, we need to protect ourselves because we're constantly bombarded with these aesthetic images that try to manipulate us. So it's hard to go around, you know, weeping at every McDonald's commercial, which I'm the same. I get affected by anything I watch, so I avoid a lot of it. But we have to protect ourselves, but at the same time, then we close ourselves off to very powerful affective experiences that could actually serve our interests, and as opposed to serving the interests of the state or the market or whatever.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the keys there is this idea of the real. Is that I think one of the things that one of the burdens we have as modern people growing up in the wake of, or you know, at the end of the 20th century in my case, but now in the wake of the 20th century, is in addition to the kind of irony and the kind of cynicism, is also a belief that any sort of aesthetic experience, any sort of encounter, even encounters in nature, anything that has that excessive quality is relative. That's just you know, it's just something that we're projecting with our brains. It's because of the way we were raised. There's nothing real there. And part of, I think, the move that you make, and that a lot of philosophers are making in a lot of different ways, and not necessarily ones who are as interested in resurrecting older symbolic forms of experience as you are, but that there is this turn towards the real, and that we can't let go, you know, of the notion that there is we have a capacity to encounter the real. It's not the same thing as understanding how reality works rationally. It's not the same thing as what science gives us information of. Well, we now know that, you know, the planets aren't gods. They're just these rocks. That's what reality is. It's like, no, that's not the kind of reality that we're talking about. We're talking about something more expressive, more experiential, but also still with this element of the unknown, of the weird, of the peculiar, of the ungraspable. And that would, I guess, one of the questions I'd spin off of that is, you do talk about beauty, a totally unhip term, a reactionary term for many art critics and many artists. But you talk about it in a particular way that isn't just the sort of typical idea of beauty that we get in fashion magazines or whatever. I think that your idea of beauty partly gets us to this idea of the real and the weird that's just lurking around the corner.
Okay. Well, I think our suspicions about beauty and our reluctance to kind of embrace that term as we once might have is totally justified. I think Adorno famously said there can be no poetry after Auschwitz, and I think there's some truth to that, although he didn't mean it the way it's usually used. But what he said was that some traditional forms of beauty, some traditional ideas of beauty, have shown themselves to be inapplicable to the real, to reality, to life as we live it. Some forms of beauty are actually political, ideological constructs that we would do well to transcend. At the same time, Adorno doesn't give up on the beautiful. What he's saying is that we have to seek for what beauty actually is. And what I say in the book is that this great revolution, this great rebellion against beauty that characterizes modernist and postmodern art, is in fact a search for a deeper form of the beautiful, something that is real, something that is, you know, beauty in the end describes a meaningfulness that is not dependent on the human. When you believe in beauty as an objective component of the real, you're saying that there's an intentionality to the world, there's a meaning in the world. Meaning's probably the wrong word, but there's something going on there that's bigger than us, and that our ideas are derivative of, as opposed to their being derivative of our ideas, you know. So this idea of the beautiful as that which is, regardless of what we feel or what we want, that which looks at us, the beauty looks at us instead of we looking at it, this idea that there's something deep in the world, in creation, that speaks to us is I think something that we need to. It's not something that ever went away. It's just something we pretend doesn't exist right now. So I'm talking here about mystical experiences and all that stuff. I mean, so I don't know if that really answers the question. It gets complicated fast.
Well, yeah. Can you speak on that a little bit? Because even if you take art history, like they kind of separate art into these different factions of, you know, that proper art and bad art, and where it kind of weaves in between. And a lot of, like, what they talk about when people started to make, you know, what would be considered proper art was, like, when perspective started to happen. So, like, when people could go from their egotistical projections onto the world, and then people could actually, like, be receptive and kind of, like you were saying, like, see what's really there instead of kind of just seeing themselves everywhere in that very sort of narcissistic way that the occultists talk about it, and the philosophers as well. So mm-hmm. did you, like, in your review of some of these concepts of, like, those larger objective perspective art, did you come across techniques that some of these artists would use? Like, did you find they would just straight use mystical techniques to do it? Or what, did you find any difference between, like, the activities of the artists between the sort of ego art and the proper art?
I didn't find anything, any consistent kind of techniques. And I don't think it's necessary for artists to be mystics or to believe in anything in order to create great works of art. However, I believe that we're all on some level, we're all mystics. We're all these strangers floating in a mystery. And the more we recognize that on a deep level, the more likely it is that the things we produce in the world will reflect that consciousness. I mean, it's not up for debate that life is a mystery. It's not up for debate that we don't know what anything is about. It's quite possible that the world was created 10 seconds ago with memories implanted into our brains to give us a semblance of a past. It's quite possible that the world is actually something very different than what we think it is. In fact, if we compare the way we understand the universe today and the way we understood it 500 years ago, we see a huge difference, obviously, in the way we conceive of the cosmos and of nature. And that's probably going to be the same in 500 years from now. I mean, the idea that we've got to figure it out is patently absurd when you consider how many anomalies are still happening and how many questions are still remain unanswered. So a consciousness of mystery is all it takes, I think, to live on that plane, to enter into communion with reality as it actually is. It's not a matter of adopting a technique, or although those can help, obviously, but just some people are in touch with that, and some people can't get over it. Emily Dickinson could never get over the fact that grass was growing outside her house. It blew her freaking mind. And whenever she sat down, she'd write about grass or trees or birds like they were these weird, bizarre monsters. You know, she couldn't get over the fact of existence. There's this joyful, terrible engagement with the mystery of things that I think is at the core of most great artist's work.
Yeah, and I think that really comes through your writing and your examples. And I particularly enjoy the way you talk about what I think of as the weird. That's sort of my term for this space that's sort of in our world but not quite following the rules. It has something sublime in it, something kind of horrible in it, something amazing, something astonishing, and yet often a little uncomfortable. It's not our world exactly. It's not who we are. If it is, it's something very deep. And I've noticed in my own life, you know, I'm kind of in middle age now or getting into it or whatever. I'm not really sure what that means. But, you know, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. When I was younger, I was just driven for extraordinary experience, man. I mean, I would seek it out in any way I could. And, you know, the heavy duty stuff, the overwhelming stuff, you know, that whether it was something that I was developing in meditation or throwing myself into strange, bizarre experiences or whatever. And I found, to my kind of delight and amazement, that even though in many ways my life is a little bit more staid, I'm doing a lot of work, I kind of, you know, I spend a lot of time at home, da da da, my actual experience of the world is way more marvelous and weird than it was when I was much more aggressive about seeking out these experiences, because there's a kind of, weirdness just to immanence itself, just to the continued existence of things as such, through the wind, the grass, the car sounds, noise, just the experience of sound alone, you know, is kind of extraordinary. And so I find that I experience art in a very, very different way, very mm-hmm. different way, much more aware of textures and context and particular opportunities, the encounter, that's one of the words that I think that you use too a lot. Yeah. That I think is a really good way to get into this mind frame without worrying too much about what it means, what does it say about the nature of reality. It's just to say, look, whatever else is happening in your life, you have encounters. These are encounters with people, with animals, with the strange you know, homeless guy on the street with the knife, and then the guy afterwards. You know, there are these series of encounters, and art is part of those encounters.
Yes.
And every encounter is an event, an invitation, a rift, a something more. And allowing that to exist, I think, is really a part of what you're arguing for. Do you have any good example of one of these sort of encounters in your own life that really showed you
what art
can have? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There have been many, many, many. Strangely enough, I kind of limit my intake of art because it tends to send me on these conceptual journeys that they go all over the place. So in order to keep some kind of consistency in my life and to work on things, I have to control it. Recently I saw Inherent Vice, and when I was watching it, have you seen it?
I have.
Yeah. While I was watching it, I was more or less into it, kind of enjoying some of the images and, you know, kind of just taking it in for what it was. It wasn't quite following the plot. I mean, I've never read the book, so I wasn't quite following the plot. And then 2 days later, it just exploded in my head. You know, it just absolutely, and all of a sudden it became imperative that I see it again. And when I did, it was this really profound experience. And I think that P.T. Anderson, I think, is a very, very talented writer-director that is able to let his instincts guide him, and somehow able to convince his producers to let those instincts guide him. And he really comes up with these bizarre, incredible films that are filled with these types of encounters. So that was one recent experience. I also watched Alien last week for the first time. I never watched the first Alien. I'd seen Aliens like 12 times when I was a kid, so I watched Alien, and I was blown away by that movie. I think that that movie, despite what the intentions of the filmmakers were or whatever, I don't know the story behind the film, but to me it's a very, very intense, prophetic movie about social Darwinism and technology and all that. So those are the ideas in it, but on a deeper level, it's just that the pure affective level of seeing that alien, and it just really struck me as something really powerful. So, and that speaks to us on many levels. So those are two examples recently for me. Yeah,
those are great examples. Well, we got more to talk about, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with J.F. Martel about his new book, Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou with Eric Davis. We are talking with J.F. Martel about reclaiming art in the age of artifice. And I personally wanted to ask you a little bit, I've been having just kind of themes of time and timelessness come up a lot, and I wonder if in your work, because I know part of what you talk about is how, you know, like you said, you saw Alien for the first time, it obviously came out a long time ago, but you could still find relevance, and how there are those classical artworks where it's like art is a wizard that can go through time and space. Like, we can't personally, but people can, like, make stuff that can traverse areas of time and space that their flesh seemingly can't, right? Until, you know, whatever the Earth or outer space kind of eats everything and turns it into dust or whatever is happening. So could you talk a little on kind of the role of that aspect? Like, how it can, I mean, maybe that's just part of the big mystery that we'll never know. But I wonder if you get to some, like, especially with old, like, primitive art even, and how that can cross these seemingly vast stretches that connects people over time and space.
Yeah. That's a really interesting question. I think it goes right to the core of it. It's probably be easier for me to talk about the real if I approach it through that, as opposed to beauty, which is so loaded. But I think art does something unique, and it's that it presents us with symbols. And symbols are different from signs. You know, like, we could construe the world as this semiotic network where everything's signifying something else, and that's how organisms kind of move their way through it and engage with others and all that stuff. But there are certain signs in the human field of perception or experience. There are certain signs that come up that are through some kind of innate power they have, become symbols. And art is, I think, art is the practice of framing out signs to turn them into symbols. I mean, that's as close to a definition as I can get. So a photographer will be walking down the street in Cairo. He'll see a darkened doorway that might be, this is an example from the book, that might be leading to the latrines behind some bar. But he takes a picture of it, and the framing out of that dark door, and then it's becoming this, its own thing in the frame, releases, kind of liberates that door from its semiotic network that it was stuck in that Cairo bar. And it becomes a door to what? A door to the underworld? A door to some dungeon, an entrance into the soul. You know, like you could go on and on trying to interpret what that is. The enigmatic and ambiguous nature of artistic objects is an essential part of the power they hold, and that's what makes them so powerful. And it's what enables us to reinterpret them again and again and again through the ages. You know, like people, you can get as much from Hamlet today as you ever could, probably maybe more. You know. So these things they're inexhaustible wells of meaning in a certain sense. That you can reinterpret them again and again.
Yeah, it seems like that's connected to what you were saying earlier about just leaving it open, right? It seems like maybe those symbols that are able to achieve those power are ones that have that kind of openness to be whatever, yes. Like any possibility, right?
Yeah, I'm using the word symbol in the sense that Jung developed, which is signs that point us to aspects of reality that remain unconscious, right? So symbols are things that connect us with things we don't know and cannot know. We can't know them. So the moon, as a symbol, connects us to all these other energies and themes and stuff that are interconnected in some way, but we don't know what they're all pointing to. So, you know, the old associations of the moon with the tides and the ocean and water and all that stuff. There's a kind of logic to it that's beyond our understanding. It's not something we can just explain. And that's why these things are so powerful. And that's why they mean new things for each generation.
Yeah, and it also seems that we got that for the symbols to stay alive, they have to open out and change as well. I mean, things that were probably very richly symbolic for earlier cultures now are almost kitschy because some of those associations, like with the moon with women,
yeah.
You know, it's like, well, obviously there's this tremendous lunar rhythm that's implied in menstruation and, you know, I mean, you can keep going. It totally makes sense. And yet to just sort of go, oh, yes, well, it's a moon. It's a female symbol in a way. And that's kitschy. So there's an interesting balance where there are some of those old resonances they're never going to go away. And yet to not just reduce that to a kitschy sign, they also have to be renovated. And I think one of the ways they get renewed today in particular is to like – open up the possibility of the symbol farther and farther into the cosmos, which is also a chaos. You know, it seems to me that part of what's happening now is that for symbols to live, they can't just be from the history of human culture, from, you know, the way humans think, the way that we have told stories to each other for millennia. They also have to have a 1 foot, to use an anthropomorphic metaphor, 1 foot in the inhuman cosmos, that which is outside of us, because it's that outsideness that's also real that gets it going, that gets the agency or the action kind of going in the event.
The danger of using the term symbol at all is that it brings up that terrible possibility of reducing symbols to these kind of like alchemical signs that we can know and we can describe, like a dictionary of symbols kind of approach. And that's the symbol in the book. I try to distance myself from that by saying the symbol is always an event. It's always unique. It's always happening now. It's like the flash of lightning. It's not something that you can put in a dictionary and say, oh, the moon equals women, you know, like that type of the associations have been there and may be there still in some way, but they always point to something that's not known, something outside, like just like you said, something outside the human precinct, something that we can't get at semiotically or directly. We have to be oblique. We have to invoke it or evoke it through.
Well, yeah, the original story of the word symbol was, I don't know if you guys know it, but it was Mercury or Hermes, and he was like walking down a beach, and he was like, God, I wish I could like make some music right now. He was like, I really feel like making some music. So he's walking along the beach, and then this empty turtle shell washes up on the beach, and he goes, aha, and he like points at it, and he goes, symbol, and then he starts playing it like a drum.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that
story. It was like
story.
Unique That's, to that yeah. moment. It was, he needed a thing, and then the thing was there. So what he wanted inside was on the outside. So you're right, it's like, it's in that moment only. There's some kind of tie there.
Yeah.
Well, it's all, go ahead.
Well, the word symbol in Greek is etymologically the original. It's like two. It's like half of something, or like the word symbol was used, I believe, for the seal that a messenger would bring, and he'd connect it with another seal to prove that he came from the right. You know, to kind of officiate a letter or officialize a letter. So this idea that the symbol is only a half of something, that there's something missing in it. It's pointing us towards something we don't know about.
One of the points you make in the book is that returning to art from the world of artifice, that in some sense art has to be decoupled from explicit sort of political agenda, from what we would think of as at the extreme of propaganda. You use propaganda and on the one hand and pornography on the other as an example of the kind of debasement of aesthetics as they get linked to very instrumental kinds of needs. Now, of course, in our world today, that you can't escape in the broader sense, politics, also always in the narrow sense as well. But certainly, many of the issues and concerns that people have, people feel that the idea that there was some kind of time and space in their lives when they can just have aesthetic experiences that are outside of all of these crushing concerns that we're facing, people might say, what's the point of further decoupling aesthetics from the actual situations that we're facing? And I think you have a really good response to that, and it's an important one, to both affirm that the art kind of art you're talking about does rupture the intentionality, and that almost all of us smell that and works even when they're supporting a political perspective that we heartily agree with. If it's too close, you're like, ah. And even if it's sort of not that close, but you can tell it was all designed just to really put forward that idea, there's sort of a weird, often a kind of deflation to it. Not always, but sometimes. I mean, there are great works of propaganda, as well, that we have to sort of see as being kind of, profoundly fascinating and rich, mm-hmm. even if they're deplorable in other ways, or at least very, instrumental. But there are ways in which reclaiming this space, opening up the rift, invoking the symbol, can actually holds out the possibility of us engaging our current situation in a different way. So I know you've thought a lot about this problem, and so I'd love to hear a little bit about how you see the kind of aesthetics you're talking about actually re-engaging or allowing us to deal with the kind of crisis that we're in.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's something to the spirit of play, and that when we enter into that spirit of play where we forget about instrumentality and we're doing something for its own sake, it's not so much that we're separating ourselves from the reality of politics so much as we're creating something that the reality of politics and all that is supposed to support. I think the whole point of politics is to create a society where people can explore the real and experience authenticity. So it's not so much that by encouraging art and encouraging art making and the appreciation of art, we're actually creating a society where humans can do what humans do, which is, if you go back to the oldest civilizations, and the most the shamanic cultures, they spend a lot of their time in the aesthetic, developing aesthetic objects, telling stories. This is what humans do for some reason we don't know. And today we're doing less and less of that. Even our stories aren't doing that. They seem to be geared towards making us act a certain way. And I think there's something to entering into that spirit of contemplation, contemplating nature, contemplating the real as it is, contemplating the mystery that we are all living in, that's available almost uniquely in art today. That's basically the only place we have left for it in secular culture. So, does that answer your question?
Totally. I mean, another way of seeing it is that if you take that the distinction you made between the sign and the symbol being an invitation to this kind of encounter, and the sign being sort of an object in a network that's referring to some other sign, is you can see that very much in terms of what's happening with media now, and how the way that networks are operating is that networks are a great example of signs referring to other signs, that we're all immersing ourselves in a variety of networks more and more, and that a great deal of the material that's produced on those networks, whether they're apps or they're new kinds of whole sort of domains of information, of ways of organizing people, of making aesthetic events, that a lot of the creative or the kind of cultural production that's happening now inside of networks is being driven by very quantitative models of how information is processed, statistics, correlations, preferences, engineering the relationships of signs and people as signs. Like, there's this whole sort of kind of computational model of how culture operates, particularly in a technological network society. And we're just diving into that. We're like plunging in as far as we can go. And I think what you're offering us or reminding us is that in art, and I think also in personal experience, but that's in a way
absolutely
a different topic, but in both of these things, there are opportunities, there are ways of setting oneself up and in relationship to others too. These are expressive acts. They're not just something that I do off on my own, where you rupture those networks or avoid them, and that there's another space that you continues to be possible, or at least a moving space. Maybe we have to constantly be on our toes, because the minute you have a successful symbolic event, it becomes incorporated in so many different ways. I could think of Burning Man as a great example for that, where Burning Man was like everything outside the network, and now it's almost a hyperactive a symptom of class, cash, technology, manipulation, mass hypnotism. All those things sort of came back in even greater, and so there's sort of a moving target of doing this. So in your own life, you got a family, you got to make money, you're working artist, you're a writer. How do you kind of cultivate that space as an active place, either in your relationship to the world or in the things you put out in the world?
Well, one of the things is to keep fighting to produce films that I want, to write the scripts I want to direct. And that in Canada is a very long process and very arduous, because it's film is so expensive. So, but obviously by creating art, I try to I automatically enter into that mode. But I also find that I on a very banal, concrete level, I take walks, and it's often by taking walks in the city or hiking in the woods that I find myself completely freed of that whole, mimetic, semiotic prison that has been constructed around us. And so of course, when you're with your family, it's a lot of these ideas, these kind of quantitative ideas of society and how relationships should work, and this are innate. They're patently absurd when you're in a family situation with your children and your wife. Like, a lot of these things become so false, or they ring so false when you're in authentic relationships, that it's that's sometimes that's all you need. of course, these things are under threat today, the family with, the, you know. But so these are things that I do to try to connect with that. And I think that everyone connects with what I'm talking about in the book, and what I'm certainly not the only one talking about that. I think a lot of people connect with that. It's just that we lack a kind of cultural public discourse about these things. There's no place for mystery in the public sphere right now. There's no place for a recognition of mystery as a fundamental component of reality in the public sphere. It seems like it's something that each of us has to experience alone. And I think that art is a way, and recognizing those works of art that call us to that is one way of rekindling that type of communal dimension, you know.
Yeah, and I think it one of the other the features of it is that it allows us to do that without, for the most part, getting involved with the problems of religion. Because mm-hmm. once you have a public discourse around the mystery, and then you make it a capital M mystery, and then we start to agree on how the mystery works, and it's over here and it's not over there, and then suddenly we get into these problems of kind of making it another form of consensus or another form of control. And, you know, I think there are ways that religion or religious scenes can also avoid that, or can kind of make it a more complicated situation. But in a lot of ways, resuscitating a larger role for art is a, you know, a great way to do that. But it is also about training. You know, it's like I know that my capacity to experience the kinds of things you're talking about by reading Moby Dick, or mm-hmm. by, you know, whatever, looking at Bosch or whatever it is partly because I was lucky and that I was around people who helped encourage this. And I went through systems of relating to books and to teachers, and mostly to people, to friends, to people who are also interested in these things. But I can remember very specifically, like I latched on to a friend. I was living in Paris, and a friend was taking a class in art appreciation, and it was in French, and my French wasn't great, but it was all right. And I tagged along to the class when they went to the Musée d'Orsay, and I'll never, ever forget the way the guy explained what Cézanne was doing with apples and with color and with plane. And even though my French wasn't great, like, I totally understood what he was saying, and it was an absolute revelation. You know, it was like I can never see those things again the same. I always am amazed by Cézanne. It will never stop. It's an event that will continue through my life. But I had the opportunity to have that rarefied kind of, you know, explanation, a gesture or whatever. And so then it gets into these difficult situations about where in this very instrumental culture, very driven culture, very hyperactive culture, are there spaces for you? You know, I mean, you must think about this looking at your kids. We only have a couple minutes left, but, you know, when you look at your kids, what do you think about that? Yeah.
Well, I'm worried for my kids, but I think we all have a responsibility to try to make this world better for our kids in all kinds of ways. But, you know, just about that point you made, if you look at, you know, before mass communications, before television, before the radio, you had a very vibrant folk music scene, you know, like I'm French Canadian. So, I mean, my ancestors, all they did was get together in kitchens and sing songs. That's art. And it doesn't require that much sophistication to connect to the deep symbolic resonances of melody and narrative and story and in songs. I think that type of, we call ourselves interactive and interconnected today, but you can't compare it to the interconnectedness of a pre-TV culture, you know, in a certain sense, where these songs would evolve from generation to generation. If you listen to Robert Johnson, I mean, the people Robert Johnson played to, the blues, you know, master, these people were probably mostly illiterate. And yet the songs, you can listen to them today and they're filled with meaning. They're filled with potency, like affective potency that can really throw you into some dark and luminous places. So I think that there's a sophisticated type of art, Moby Dick, you need a lot to get there, but there's also, art's not just this rarefied kind of elite thing. It's also something that's just absolutely imminent to us as human beings. This is what we've been doing since the start. It's the first sign that we ever did anything, right?
Wonderful. Well, I think we're going to have to leave there. J.F.
Right.
Martel, Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice. Thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. All right. So you can check out that book. It's on North Atlantic. And also, if you go to reclaimingart.com, you can see JF with a nice little article about why he wrote the book. So from me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open. Mm-hmm.